Hi there, this is Hal Phillips, and welcome to The Curmudgeon, the golf podcast here at halphillips.net. Rory McIlroy's recent triumph in the U.S. Open at Congressional spurred the reopening of a topic I've tackled in print, something I like to call the Cinderella Complex, the curious predilection we golf fans and media have for rooting against underdogs and for the favorites. It's a bit twisted, really. It's also eternally relevant. John Strawn read the piece and we talked about it on The Curmudgeon this week. John is a fellow A positioner, CEO of Hills and Forest International Golf Course Architects, the author of the book Driving the Green. Apologies for the sound quality on this pod. Rest assured that the crickets and sound engineer responsible have been sacked.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really good.
I remember, just to get things started, is that I remember this dynamic sort of happening to me. So I'm not really picking on golf or golf fans in particular, because I'm part of the problem. But during the Open that was held at Troon that Todd Hamilton ended up winning, I remember him hitting a drive on the 72nd hole, and he absolutely almost missed a 2-iron that he screwed into the tall grass, and it looked like he was going to, you know, the wheels were falling off, and he was going to lose this tournament. And if I recall, Mickelson and Ernie Els were right behind him. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, good. Now someone who's worthy will win this tournament. And then I was like, that is so wrong.
Right.
And what is it about golf that makes us, you know, root for the overdog? I can understand it in media, because I think it's easier, you know, for media to talk about a known quantity, to hype, Tiger Woods and now Rory McIlroy, because they know what to expect. But, you know, the fact is that you know, the 150th player on tour could go out and beat Rory McIlroy in a match play tomorrow, 6-5, and no one would be shocked.
Right. People who don't know the game well might be surprised. But anybody who knows the difference between the guys at the very top and the players that are also rents can be half a shot per round over a season.
Exactly. So it's not quantifiable. It's not anything we can count on. But, and like you said, people who don't know golf don't really get that. But we presumably do know golf. So why are we shocked when Steve Jones beats Tom Lehman to win the Open? And why is it, but even more important, why does it disappoint us?
Exactly. Why does it disappoint us? This is the big question, and I've been thinking about it since you pointed it out yesterday. I even raised the topic at dinner last night with my family. We had grandkids and kids over, and we raised this question, and nobody had a really very good take on it. Why we? Maybe it has something to do with a general desire to see records broken, or to see some. If you watch a race in the Olympics and a world record is broken, that somehow seems like a more exciting outcome than simply a victory. Like if Usain Bolt had won all those gold medals, but in less than world record time, would he be as celebrated? I don't think so. So there's, you know, if Jack Nicklaus has set the standard as the greatest competitive golfer of all time, greatest competitive professional golfer of all time, we're sort of cheering for Tiger in part because of his pursuit of that record. Even though I don't think, you know, Tiger was always admired and respected, but I don't think he was ever, loved the way I think Rory McIlroy has the potential for a lot of love from the public.
I suppose that's true. But Nicklaus was never loved either. He was respected. They loved Arnie, and Jack kicked his ass for, 20 years.
Right, right.
It's interesting just to throw, this is one of these conversations you just don't have an answer. But, this plays in a funny way into the best player never to have won a major discussion. Colin Montgomery is for a long time, was the guy who had never, you know, the best player on the planet who had never won a major. And it wasn't even that we were rooting for him to end it. We wanted someone to pick on. And if it came down to him winning a major or Tiger winning another major, we'd be rooting for Tiger.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting to me. Because, I mean, I definitely felt that in myself. And clearly the fact that ratings were off the charts when Tiger was leading a tournament on Sunday. And when he's not playing or not leading, the ratings collapse, which, you know, is kind of confirmation that what people are looking to see is the triumph of the greatest player rather than a lifetime performance by a regular player, an ordinary player.
You are exactly right. And I remember when Tiger won the Masters, I think they set a ratings record.
Yeah.
And when Tiger won the British Open in 2000 at St. Andrews and just lapped the field.
Yeah.
I believe they also set a ratings record.
Yeah.
And I believe when Tiger won the U.S. Open by 15 strokes at Pebble Beach.
Exactly.
Now, what is it that makes someone want to watch that tournament? I honestly turned off the tournament. I remember turning off the British Open that year because it was such a disappointment that it was over, you know, basically on Saturday. And and honestly, I watched the event on Sunday with Rory. It was all coronation, no drama, no competitive drama. I watched it because I was, you know, watching it with my dad. It was sort of the Father's Day thing to do. But I wouldn't have watched it otherwise. But people love to watch that. Why?
Well, let me see if I can do an internal examination here, because I'm one of the ones who loved watching that.
Okay.
And the only anxiety I felt, frankly, was fear of failure for Rory, that somehow he would echo or replicate the meltdown in Augusta. As you know from my own blog, I didn't think that would happen, and I was really quite confident that it wouldn't happen. But, you know, I'm not Nostradamus. I didn't have a crystal ball. I just thought that was the case because of the way he had carried himself emotionally. He was the anti-Tiger in failure. He stood up, and the lesson he learned from Augusta was, I led the hardest tournament in the world for three and a half rounds, and only failed in 9 holes. Anybody can have a 9-hole meltdown. What did I learn about pace, rhythm, shot routines, thinking my way through the round and so on, that I'll take to the next tournament? And when he said that, people were a little dubious, but in fact, he handled himself perfectly on Sunday. And so my excitement in watching it was rooting him through the 18th green, hoping he would set the records. So there again, I'm rooting for the overdog. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to beat the open record. I don't know, Hal. I think you're onto something really great that's unique to golf. And I think if we can figure it out, it will be a real insight into the game.
Well, there's an interesting corollary, to this dynamic that pertains to Vania. We touched on it briefly. For example, some observers, consider in retrospect open winners from a particular venue like the Olympic Club in San Francisco. And they look at the fact that Jack Fleck beat Ben Hogan there. Casper beat Palmer there. Scott Simpson beat Tom Watson there. Lee Jansen beat Payne Stewart there. And they conclude that the course is somehow diminished or lesser because it didn't produce a great champion. Whereas a place like Pebble Beach, Nicklaus, Watson, Tom Kite, Tiger Woods, does produce great champions. You know, I know the Olympic Club underwent a huge renovation in response to the fact, in part, that, you know, the wrong guy won there over and over. What do we suppose that it's going to have, you know, is Congressional going to get another open? Not only did, well, the right guy arguably won there, but did he win too easy? I mean, the guy who finished second was, what, 800, 900? That would be a high score. Anyway.
800 would have been a brilliant performance in just about any U.S. Open ever.
I think Jason Day would have won all but 2 U.S. Opens ever contested at 800.
Yeah, yeah. And you had 20 guys who were at U.S. Open winning level scores. So yeah, I don't think Congressional is going to be in the rota again. I think it's and you know, the other thing I read that I really enjoyed the Sports Illustrated symposia that they have before each major with Michael Bamberger and Shipnuck and an anonymous pro, John Garrity. They talk about what they think is going to happen. They're almost always wrong, but within the discussion, it's always entertaining and always enlightening. And one of the things Michael Bamberger said was, he's caddied at Congressional a number of times and played there, and he can't remember any of the holes.
Really?
Yeah. And so he was really poo-pooing the course. This was before the event, and saying, you know, it's really not worthy. It's not Oakmont. It's not Olympic Club. It's not, you know, Marion. It's, you know, it doesn't have the quality of those courses. And yet the winners it produced were, you know, pretty important players. I mean, Venturi and Els are not outriders.
No. And I think that, in short, the argument that is indulged in, you know, this whole idea that a golf course produces good champions or poor champions, I think it's a canard, and you can't back it up. It's just a convenient way for us to make our arguments about, you know, why golf should produce great champions. You know, once you win a major, you should beat a guy who's never won a major. And I think that they say it takes 2 points to make a line. You know, someone like Sean McKeel, who you mentioned earlier, is he a great player? Is he a major? He's one of those guys that, like Orville Moody, who jumped in there and won a major to everyone's chagrin.
Michael Campbell.
Michael Campbell. But then you have people like Andy North.
Yeah. I was going to raise, what do you think? And here's Andy North. A wonderful person, by the way. I really like his commentary. He seems like a kind and, you know, intelligent, generous-spirited person. He only won 2 tournaments in his entire career. You know, probably at injuries, and they were both U.S. Open.
That's astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's to me. It's it. All of these outliers who end up winning are proof of what I think we all understand, which is that over the course of 4 days, any pro on earth can beat any other pro.
Right, exactly.
It's harder over 4 days than it would be over 3 or 2 or 1, but we've seen it over and over again. It can happen. But,
yep.
You know, we keep coming back to the idea that we don't want it to happen, and why.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think part of us really does think that someone who's won a couple majors is a different sort of player mentally. On account of their victories, it does something to them. It makes them, you know, better. It makes them hallowed. And I don't think it does. You know, look at John Daly. He won a couple of majors. Does he have any kind of mental sort of capacity or metal that makes him able to beat somebody else when the chips are down? You know, no.
He's a great example. I mean, here's a guy who had, you know, talent to burn, which he did. And yet, if he could hold it together for 4 rounds, he could be the greatest player in the world. But typically, you know, he couldn't. And he's a guy who had the sort of emotional composure on the course of a 14 handicapper.
That's right. He smoked like a fiend, and he stopped smoking or stopped drinking. He was eating just jelly beans and M&Ms like by the handful.
And hit a bad shot and would just quit, just give up.
Yeah, he walked off a couple times, didn't he?
Yeah, and which is the kind of thing that, you know, guys that are... I mean, that's funny. You know, John Daly had the swing of a +8 and the emotions of a 15.
I don't say that because I have the swing and the emotions of a 15.
So, Well, I think, Hal, this is a great subject to continue to noodle and try to digest, because I feel exactly the same way that you've described. I mean, I'm always rooting for the great ones, you know, and I have a powerful empathy for people who are in trouble. Probably the most, you know, the most painful memories in golf for me to have witnessed were, you know, like Vandereld.
Yeah.
Even Phil, you know, at Wingfoot, making a bonehead decision. You know, it's. I don't like seeing people melt down. You know, Rory, it was terrible seeing him four putt and just clearly be in the grips of a mild hysteria. That's, you know, I'm proud of him for recognizing and overcoming it. I think lesser talents, lesser emotionally composed people, you know, would not recover from something like that.
No, I think it helps that he's 21, and I think Johnny Miller said something very interesting. He said, you know, when you're young and you play freely and without fear, which I think a lot of 21-year-old players do, good and bad,
yeah,
they do it because they don't have any sort of sense for the consequences of their actions, which none of us do when we're 21.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, I think that goes for the ability to bounce back from you know, an 80 on the final day at Augusta. I mean, you're just not prepared to absorb the consequences of what you've just done for good and ill. And in that case, it was for good.